they're bleeding at it.
Senate Health, Education, Social Services Committee will please come to order. Let the record show that Senator Rees, Senator Josephson, and myself are present. Since we are not acting on bills today, we can get started without a quorum. I'm sure the rest will be here.
We have a quorum, though.
Oh, I forgot. I don't have a seven-man committee.
No.
Thank you for reminding me. Old habits die hard and slow. And I'm happy today to have with us Commissioner Pugh. And John, would you just proceed as you like with your directors? Members of the committee, ask questions at any time you feel that it's important to break in.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Pugh. I'm Commissioner of Health and Social Services. And I have with me today Connie Seif, who is Deputy Commissioner of Health and Social Services, and then the directors of the various divisions, and I'll have them introduce themselves as they come up to talk about their pieces of the department. Just to give you a little background on the Department of Health and Social Services, it is the second largest department in state government after the Department of Transportation. The department has 1,700 employees, and the fiscal year 85 budget was $302 million. Of which $75 million comes from federal funding, federal programs. The department's budget this year, as we look at FY86, then will be approximately $331 million if the governor's budget is passed by the legislature, for an 8.6% overall increase over the FY85 authorized. In the department, we are divided into two sections. The section that we call social services and the section that we call health. The social services section consists of the divisions of public assistance and division of medical assistance and the division of family and youth services. The health section is composed of the division of public health, the division of mental health and developmental disabilities, and the office of alcoholism and drug abuse. So the department is divided basically into six line divisions that handle the caseloads throughout the state in the various program areas. Just to kind of give you a little bit of an idea of the magnitude of the department's business in Alaska, or our programs in Alaska, in the public health division alone, in the Department of Health and Social Services, we serve over 140,000 different Alaskans each year. Out of a population of a little over 500,000, that's a significant amount of Alaskans who actually come and access our program. In addition, if you look at an area such as public assistance, in any given month, we are serving over 25,000 families in Alaska through our public assistance program. I could go down each one of the divisions in similar numbers, but I will let each division director go through that as they come up. But I did want to indicate to you the magnitude of our response in Alaska. We have estimated recently that we probably serve unduplicated over 200,000 Alaskans through the Department of Health and Social Services in any given year. That means that approximately 40% of all Alaskans access the department's programs in any given fiscal year. In terms of our goals for this coming year, I would like to reiterate some of the things that we have been attempting to do in recent years. The department has been moving in the direction of trying to expand its preventive efforts in each of its divisions in order to attempt to try to actually help individuals or families prior to the time when they actually need heavy emphasis on delivery of services. We found that that's much cheaper. It also enables us to be able to help a broader spectrum of people through preventive networks such as school systems, such as oftentimes daycare centers, even church-related areas in which we're invited in to talk about various kinds of programs. You can see particular emphasis in this, for example, in public health and our communicable disease program, where in fact we're attempting to prevent the spread of disease and attempt to be able to stop that disease at an early stage. In other areas, it's not quite as classical in the sense that, for example, in alcoholism, drug abuse, we use education programs, other kinds of media techniques to try to get individuals to understand the impact of alcohol or drugs on an individual, and so that individual can make a good choice about the utilization of those substances. And as we go forward in our goals in the department, if we cannot prevent something from happening, or disease, or the individuals from utilizing substances that are bad for them or making bad decisions, then the goal of the department is to try to intervene early enough so that the damage to that individual or to that family is not significant enough that we might have to break the family up or remove individuals from the home and place them in an expensive type of restrictive care. So our next level is to intervene early, and that's real important as we look at the budget this year, and we'll have Family and Youth Services talking about that in terms of child abuse and neglect, because a good piece of the emphasis in that budget this year is to try to ensure that we can intervene early, investigate, and try to get into families and be able to work with those families early on rather than waiting until children are damaged to a point where they do need some kind of out-of-home type of care. The third piece of our goals is if in fact we do have to intervene, that we provide some kind of treatment or rehabilitation either through the department or through various grants and contracts. And in fact, in the majority of cases, the department is working with private nonprofit agencies throughout the state who are providing that treatment and rehabilitation. Finally, if in fact we are unable to intervene early, and sometimes that does happen, and we end up picking up the pieces of some broken families or children who have been severely abused, sometimes we do have to use restrictive settings such as residential care or else in some instances our institutions for delinquent youth. But we attempt in the department to try to use those as last resort kind of effort. Unfortunately, as we all know, if you look at our budget, it still looks like we must be using those more than we use anything else, because the institutional costs far outweigh all the other programs in the department. And we still feel strongly that our efforts in recent years, which have been to reduce residential care, to hold down the building of new beds in juvenile corrections, is a good effort, and in fact that we feel like our preventive and early intervention efforts are making an impact. And we are continuing that in this budget that is before you and before the Finance Committee particularly. We're continuing that same effort that we have been on in the last 2 years. And I just wanted to indicate that.
Commissioner, may I
interrupt
right here? In the intervention area, have you had any meetings at all, or is there a dialogue established between you and the Department of Education as to educational types of programs for intervention, earlier prevention?
Yes, there has been. Commissioner Reynolds and I have met, and we have had some of his staff have met with ours to work particularly in the area of early childhood education, preventive programs in that area, and also this year to begin planning for possible parenting programs throughout the school system in Alaska, where we could develop a good curriculum for parenting, which we feel would be very helpful in preventing child abuse and neglect. My understanding is that in the budget, he was not funded for the pilot project that he originally put in that area, but I do think that his people are continuing to work with curriculums with local school districts to try to encourage them to develop those kinds of classes in the local school districts, and we are continuing to work with him in that area.
I noticed in reviewing some of the educational curriculum in Rule 48 that there are some institutions that are using parenting programs, and it seems to me, I'm very glad to hear you say that, because it seems to me that we go into one of the most important jobs in the world with absolutely no training and no help in preparing for that.
That's great.
Other than the experience that we have had, which is bad or good. But
when
do you see this coming about? What steps are going on? We've had dialogue about a lot of things for 20 years, but where are we?
Some school districts have actually begun curriculums on parenting. It's not just, I think, the Anchorage School District. There are some schools that already have begun parenting curriculums. There are, at least Commissioner Reynolds has indicated to me, there are other school districts that have begun, and what I think we need, both from the legislature and the executive branch, is a strong encouragement for school districts to pick up those curriculums and to make it a very high emphasis. Obviously, when Commissioner Reynolds put in some money in the budget, his intent was to try to entice some school districts to pick up those curriculums through additional funding. I think that we will continue our efforts at that, if not in this budget year, in the next budget year. And we feel strongly that that's an important aspect in prevention. And one of the things that we'd like to comment about that, in some school districts, not only have they developed parenting skill training, but they have daycare centers in high schools, which they use as the labs for their parenting training. And students from the high schools then work in the daycare centers in order to get them some actual experience of working with children. Because many families are so small nowadays that children do not have, adolescent children do not have the experiences that they had in the past of really actually working with young children. And so some of the schools down south have started daycare centers in the high schools in order to have a lab there. And that was the concept, the pilot concept that Commissioner Reynolds and I have been discussing. And that was discussed not only among us, but also with the mini cabinet on women's issues as a major emphasis.
Well, since we do have, and I know that any program of that nature needs to go statewide, but lots of programs have started in other areas to prove their worth, and I do know Anchorage is doing some of that, but do we have any curriculum worked out together? Do we have any plan? It seems to me that a little creative thinking and dedication on the part of both departments would help to bring that about without huge expenditures of money, since curriculums are available, and I just want to encourage that be continued.
Definitely, we'll do that. If there are no other questions,
I don't know if this is the point. I have several questions, though, for the commissioner. The first thing I'd like to ask you about is the present status of mental health programs in Anchorage and your relationship with the municipality of Anchorage and its reported withdrawal from mental health program administration.
Okay. At this point in time, we feel that the mental health center is doing a good job of providing the comprehensive services throughout the Anchorage borough. In fact, we had some problems with delivery of services in Whittier, in which we were able to amend their contract and increase slightly the contract in order to ensure that Whittier was getting itinerant services. And the transitional living center, which there had been some difficulties with in the last year there, has begun to function at a much better level. They have been at about 85% occupancy in the last month, 6 weeks. And so we're seeing some real help in the sense of looking at API census and the transitional living center being some relief to that. It certainly was not, you would call a totally smooth transition. There were a lot of things that had to be worked out in that transition from the municipality having control over mental health and turning it over to the private contractor who would deal directly with us. But we feel we're on our way, and we definitely feel that we're making some strides forward in that.
Is there a saving to the public in that new arrangement?
Well, there's an increase in services because of the fact that we'll put it this way, there should be an increase in services, and the fact that the administration of those programs in the municipality was eliminated from the Anchorage budget, and therefore there was a decrease in funding in that area. We are administrating those programs in the sense of monitoring and so on directly out of our regional office in Anchorage.
There was some local effort financially in mental health under the old system. Will that continue as far as you know, or will they take the position that it's a complete state responsibility?
It has continued through this year, and we're very hopeful that it will continue. There is also a significant effort in the area of alcoholism from the municipality, alcoholism and drug abuse, and we are very hopeful that those emphases will continue, even though there is some attempt, for example, in alcohol and drug abuse, to look at a cheaper way of administering the program, but to have the municipalities continue to contribute to them. At this point, there has not been any pullback of their funding, and we would hope that it will continue at the level it has in the past.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to inquire also about API, whether the facility is crowded, and I think you had accreditation inspection recently which suggested that it was too crowded, and if you could discuss that accreditation and what steps you're taking to comply with the recommendations or what your reaction to the findings were.
Well, we do have a major emphasis, and Dr. Henry is here from mental health, and I'll have him talk a little more to it.
Incidentally, the position of director of health is the Deputy Commissioner for Health is vacant. Is it intended to fill that position?
Not during this fiscal year, because if you remember, it was eliminated in the budget last year because Dr. Rabeau, prior to his death, had been holding both the Director of Public Health as well as the Deputy Commissioner of Health, and so that is not going to be filled this fiscal year. As far as API, we do continue to have an overcrowding situation where we're running anywhere from 20 to 25 beds over what our actual licensed bed capacity is. We did go through a standard review by the Joint Commission on Hospitals, and we are going to be accredited again. We had no significant deficiencies that would result in us not being accredited, but they continue to hit at the overcrowding at API, and also the situation that they're concerned about is that having the criminally insane at API has started a trend towards a higher level of security at API over the whole hospital, and that is in some way detracting from the setting as a hospital. And in a sense, what has happened is that we're becoming more of a secure facility for correctional transfers and criminally insane versus a treatment facility for those individuals who cannot afford private treatment. In our budget effort this time, we do have a transfer of that forensic unit from API to the Highland Mountain facility. It is one that is already being hotly debated because it includes 45 new positions for Highland Mountain in order to run not just a 20-bed facility that we have at API, but a 40-bed facility that would also handle transfers in from all the correctional facilities of individuals that are guilty but mentally ill, or also who may indicate that they may not be guilty or mentally ill, but they may have a psychotic or acute breakdown in a correctional facility and need that type of care. The reason we have totally new positions in there is that we plan on taking that 20-bed unit at API, keeping the staff that are presently there, and reopening it as an acute hospital setting to take up the 20-bed slack that we really need. So it's sort of a joint effort in the sense of moving the forensic unit out to the Highland Mountain and then basically reopening those 20 beds to catch up with our problem with license capacity. The second effort that we have is we do have another increment in the budget for $500,000 that we are targeting again towards the chronically mentally ill in an attempt to expand our programs out in the regions, local communities, in order that some of the chronically mentally ill that are now staying at API may be able to move out quicker and actually remain in the communities. We have started that program 2 years ago. We're having some success in the communities, but there's a great need for more dollars in the community mental health system in order to maintain those individuals in the community.
Are you saying that there are people who would benefit from or would require API institutionalization at this time who are not admitted because your beds are taken up by the criminal?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that we are running over capacity, though, in the sense that we have in the last year been at 20 or 25 beds over capacity, and we're crowding the units. And most of those units, I don't know, for those of you who have not visited API, we do not have private rooms. There are wards, and when you start crowding those wards, it gets to be pretty tight in the sense of a number of people who have psychiatric disorders having to live in a very small kind of quarters. And I think that's the situation that's a concern to us at API.
Madam Chair, excuse me.
Well, I was going to ask you about the Harborview case. Now, we're getting mail from people involved in the community care of people with developmental disabilities who are, I think it's fair to say, attacking the Harborview facility as old-fashioned or out of date or not community-based. Where do you stand with that now? What's the future of Harborview?
The future of Well, I just actually, right before Christmas in December, made a trip down to Harborview, spoke at Harborview as well as the Chamber of Commerce. There is no question that we feel at this point in time that Harborview is still needed. We have had recent examples of individuals who have left Harborview and gone to community facilities, and the community facilities were unable to handle them because of their aggressive behavior and had to be returned to Harborview. The state of the art in the community facilities is such that you cannot handle all the individuals that are at Harborview. On the other hand, our long-range plan, and we have a 5-year plan, which has been developed with the cooperation of the Governor's Council on Gifted Handicap, that the five-year plan is to reduce the overall beds at Harborview and to gradually build up the beds in the community. And a number of the individuals who are at Harborview can, in fact, be moved into to local facilities. In fact, right now, we have the lowest census we've ever had at Harborview. We are at about 75. You know, a few years ago, Harborview was at 120. And I think this is probably a very good method of deinstitutionalizing. You've got to have your treatment resources in place in the community before you move individuals. I have seen a few cases in which individuals have been moved where the resources were not available, and I think it was real tragic. We have one mother in Anchorage who has been complained that her child was getting full day schooling at Harborview and, you know, in the community of Valdez, moved to Anchorage to a facility there, and there was no daytime program available. And so basically moved from a 16-hour-a-day kind of program to an after-school program in Anchorage. And I think it's a real concern. Valdez has contributed a lot of money to put the school up in Valdez, and all individuals, whether they're below the school, whether they're school age or whether they're older than school age, do obtain schooling. Now, when you move to Anchorage, there is no, according to the Education Act, there is no responsibility for individuals beyond the age of 21 to obtain schooling, public schooling. So the only place where that is available is in Valdez at this point. And a number of the individuals who are at Valdez, at Harborview, have lived there for years, have been in that system, and I think that unless we have the resources available in the local communities, it would be a tragedy to transfer people to those local communities. So our effort has been a dual one. One, to gradually decrease the beds at Harborview and to up the availability of resources in the local communities. And I think that's going well. Last year we had $2.7 million, $2.5 put in by the governor, another $200,000 by Senator Fahrenkamp on the developmental disability. And we have another $1 million in the budget this year to increase the community system. There's a lot of argument that we need more than that, but given what we had available in the budget, I think $1 million is a fair amount of money in terms of adding the increase. And that's our, has been our direction, is to continue to increase the local community programs at this point.
If I might, Madam Chairman, just follow that up. Well, I think the question came up because ARCA in Anchorage is seeking some additional small amounts of capital money is to develop a kind of fourplex approach for eight clients and a supervisory person. Has that particular proposal come to your attention? Or
Yes, it has. But it's like talking about apples and oranges in the sense that the people who we're talking about at ARCA are the higher functioning people who can be maintained right now are being maintained in their family homes, and many of those individuals are becoming older. The parents are, and they're concerned about the future of those children, or young adults in many cases. And what they want is a group home setting, like a family, that these individuals will be able to live in, and an understanding basically that will exist beyond the parents' lifetime. And I think that's an important issue. However, that is not the individuals that are at Harborview. If you've ever visited Harborview, we're talking about profoundly mentally retarded. It's a very, very enlightening visit to go and to visit Harborview, to visit the school and see what we're working with. They start with a profoundly retarded individual and start from scratch, building up just the ability of people to move their muscles, day in and day out, ultimately to where individuals can do things for themselves and gradually gain some language. It's an amazing process over the years. And I think from that standpoint, oftentimes in the letters that you get, there is some mixing of types of individuals, and I think that needs to be clarified at any given time. When we talk about transferring somebody from Harborview, we're talking about developing a very sophisticated community program in order to handle that individual. And like I say, there have been four or five individuals where we have failed in the last 2 years because the programming was not sophisticated enough to handle those individuals.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
On this line, sir, did I understand you say you were gradually closing out Harborview?
I said we were gradually closing down beds, and we've gone from 120 beds about 10 years ago down now to about 75. When I was there, the estimate is we may have another five individuals who can move out in the next 3 or 4 months, and then we will be needing additional community beds in order to move anybody else out at that point.
Is Harborview doing a bad job or something? know people like to have the facilities within their community, but when we look at the budget constraints, how realistic is it that we have them and are able to close down Harborview?
Well, basically, they're not doing a bad job, but even the staff at Harborview indicated that they feel that certain individuals have a right to a community setting if they can make it in the community. And in fact, there are individuals in Valdez who are coming in with a request for a group home in Valdez for certain of the individuals who have no communities, you know, no ties to any communities in Alaska. They've been in Harborview for 20 or 25 years. They have no parents or relatives in Alaska, and they would like to see a group home developed in Valdez where these individuals could be in a group home there and attend the Valdez school. I think that's a good idea. Even the Harborview staff say everybody should have that opportunity when they're ready. The debate is when is somebody ready and what kind of technology do you need in the community to do it? And there have been individuals who have visited Harborview and said, if you look nationwide, there's technology to take everybody out of Harborview and put them in a local community. But if you ask at what cost, you then get dollar signs rolling around because it is very expensive for certain technology to be developed in the community that you can develop at an institutional level a lot cheaper. And I think that's tough, the situation at this point. And I think what I'm saying is I don't see in the foreseeable future that we can close Harborview. I think we need community beds, we need to improve our community system, increase the number of beds, and as people are ready at Harborview to move out, we should move them out, and that's what we've been doing. And as those close, we will close a wing at a time if we need to, and then we'll have to look at it down the line at what's viable to continue. I think there's many other uses for Harborview if we have, you know, if we close a couple of wings. It's a very structurally sound facility now, and since we've done some renovation of the roof, we've done some energy stuff there, and I think there's other uses, but at this point, I think the use that we're using it for is the best use.
Thank you. No, I'm probably more familiar with Harborview, whether you realize it or not, than most people here, because we happen to have a son there years ago, and I think I haven't seen a dedicated staff as dedicated as those folks are. I guess my question is, at what point is the cost effectiveness lost? I mean, what is the size beyond which it gets really mushroom? I know you can't keep it down to say 5 or 10 because it's total loss from an economic point of view. So what is the optimum size within budget constraints? Do you have any?
Well, I have indicated, I think at this point in the next 2 or 3 years, we're still talking, you know, we're like 5 beds per year of taking, 5 to 10 beds a year of taking individuals out. And when we reach about 40, I think we're going to reach a point where we've got the most difficult individuals, and that keeps open still a large portion of that facility. We can do some cutback of support staff when we're at that point, but you still have a large facility to heat and that kind of thing, and you start to lose some after you get probably below 60, you start to lose some cost effectiveness. However, like I say, I think there are some things that we could think about in terms of Harborview. We've just begun discussions of the possibility of maybe having some chronically mentally ill at Harborview. I mean, there's a lot of things that we can do to be cost effective, you know, to look at other programming, because we do have wings there and you can isolate the programs at Harborview. So I think the facility was well designed in that sense to be able to do some creative programming to make sure that we don't waste state dollars. So that's the kind of thing we're looking at this point.
Can that be used then to relieve some of the crowding at API?
Well, that's one of the things we are looking at this point. That in the future, rather than build some more beds at API, we may want to look at moving some of the chronically mentally ill out of API and developing a program there in a smaller community, because we probably could get better services in a smaller facility and you know, in the community. So that's the kind of thing that we have just begun to talk about. At this point, with 75 beds, there's really no necessity to do that. We're still cost effective, and I think that we remain. We're certainly competitive with community ICF MRs. We're right in the same ballpark in cost of both of the community programs as well.
Is there any program whereby, just taking a case of a child that's say at API, but they're a higher functioning child, whereby the child could go back to the home, not a group home, but the home, and the state would provide assistance there by whether it be a respite, whether it be paying somebody to come in for X number of hours a day, and it would be far more cheaper and may be the best environment for that child?
Well, at the moment, we don't have such a program. There have been, in the area of child abuse and neglect, we have used homemakers to do that in the sense of the child protection, where we'll train a homemaker to go into a home and provide that kind of service. The other kind of thing, we use daycare centers for respite for parents who are overwhelmed by young children in the area of child abuse and neglect. We have done respite care, of course, with developmentally disabled, and continue to expand that program, and it's probably one of the best programs in the state in the sense of really relieving parents and allowing children to remain at home. With the mentally ill, we've had tough times in getting programs started. We don't have respite kind of programs developed. It's things that we are looking at this point. I know the planning body in Fairbanks has looked at that kind of thing, some respite care, other kinds of ways of looking at dealing with emotionally disturbed or kids who have mental illness. And so we will be looking at that definitely, but we don't have programs at this point.
Well, Madam Chairman, on the question of cost, I would assume as a layperson that institutional care at a place like Harborview is more costly than many of the community-based service programs would be, if there are suitable alternatives to that given case. I mean, am I wrong about that?
Well, the ICFMR right now, it's hard to compare because there are capital costs in one and there's not capital costs in others, But right now, the actual daily bed rate that we utilize, I mean daily cost of bed that we give to the federal government for reimbursement for the Harborview facility and for the programs at Hope Cottages, the ICFMR programs at Hope Cottages, Hope Cottages is about 10 to 15% higher than Harborview. Now, the thing is that they're not totally comparable, because at Harborview we are not amortizing capital costs, and I'm not sure at Hope Cottage they may well be. I don't have that figured. There are some other things, for example, that Hope Cottage is paying for educational costs for the over 21. In Valdez, we're not paying for that because the school system is being picked up by Valdez. On the other hand, the community there in Valdez has been very supportive and have picked up the cost. And so in some ways you have to say, wait a minute now, you know, that this community has contributed and is contributing the educational cost, and therefore the true costs are $200 and something. So they are very comparable figures at this point. And as I mentioned, Hope Cottages is a little bit higher in the most recent figures.
One more institution that you have responsibility for is McLaughlin.
That's correct.
And what is the present situation there with respect to the overcrowding issue?
Well, I'll let Mike Price answer a little better. My understanding is that it has improved, and since we have taken over the intake function from the court, we are down now in boys detention, down in the 40s and 40s and 50s, fluctuating in that neighborhood rather than the 70s that we were in. And we feel good that we are going to be able to control our population a lot better with having the intake function. Dave Arnold, who is assistant director for juvenile corrections, indicated that that situation has improved remarkably. So. We feel good about that. And the interesting thing is that we're sort of heading into a peak time in January where we know
what does that mean when you say you've taken the intake function? I mean, would that mean that your social workers are softer on crime than court officials were? What was that?
So where do they go?
Yeah.
Well, I don't. The intake in the 3rd Judicial District and in the 4th Judicial District up in Fairbanks, the intake function had been handled by the court system. The court system during and on the 1st of December transferred that function over to the Department of Health and Social Services. Prior to this, for example, in Anchorage, there was not a 24-hour intake function. They functioned on an 8 to 4:30 or 5. They had beepers, but basically they indicated to the police, for example, on weekend, just go ahead and put the child in detention and we'll get there on Monday. We now have individuals available so that when somebody is brought into detention at any given time, we have the capability of making a determination, does this child really need to be detained or can we get them back home? And so that has significantly helped us control the gatekeep at McLaughlin and at the Fairbanks facility both. And I feel strongly, I've always felt that way. I administrated detention for 5 years in Anchorage, and it was one of those things that we had asked for many years, because I felt like if we had the gatekeeping function, we could both protect the public as well as keep a handle on our population problems there at McLaughlin.
Well, Madam Chairman, just to pursue this one more time, what I'm getting at is a sense of unease I have in what you say. I understand that that there are savings in terms of beds when you don't have to make weekend or overnight detentions of people who don't really belong there. But on the other hand, when the court did it, I presume the court would not be as conscious of what your bed space considerations were and would be more sensitive, possibly, to the public protection issue. Has the pendulum swung so that your gatekeepers are, you know, not detaining youngsters who should be detained,
no,
who represent a threat to the public peace or safety?
No, that's not. I think the perception was not correct. In fact, what was happening was, and I can, as I said, I was there 5 years, is that if a youth was detained over the weekend for a certain crime, they stayed over the weekend. If that youth was picked up for a crime during the week, they didn't stay. And when there was not a clear, utilization of standards and intake, and I think that is definitely making an impact at McLaughlin, and I think it will continue to make one. And I'm not for example, the court system did not have the same resources. That is one of the arguments that we make. We have more resources. The court system didn't have foster homes, didn't have receiving homes. We are using our resources in the department to make this work. And I think that was one of the reasons we talked to Arch Snowden about it, and he agreed. He said, you have a multitude of resources you can use. We don't have it. All we have is the function of in or out. You know, you have the resources to say, well, if we don't put them in McLaughlin, where else can we put them? Well, we can put them in a foster home. We can put them in a receiving home. We can do some kind of close probation. Mm-hmm. They had none of those resources when they were doing intake. So it's not only a function of the fact that we changed some of the criteria. We do have more resources available to us than they do. So I don't want to say that they weren't doing a good job with the resources they had. We just have more. And in fact, we have added some probation officers into this function above the intake officers that were transferred over, because we really feel that the initial contact with youth and family is the most important contact. And we're trying to do that where we meet with the family immediately after an arrest versus waiting a day or 2 days or so on. Because you make the most impact with a family if you can actually counsel with them right after the first arrest of a child.
It's been my understanding that has been very successful, particularly with those parents who were concerned of what is my child when this child isn't.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair. So, but on another subject, I thought that was a very useful discussion, because I've somewhat the same constituency and the same questions have been raised, and I think that we've had a lot of concern for a long time about API. They've been understaffed, they haven't had the maintenance dollars and some of the rest, so it's good to know there's some steps being taken there, although it throws a load somewhere else in the system. My question had to do with your remark on the with youth not using the institutional facilities as much, but trying to take the place of other alternatives. And kind of consistently over the years, we've had the youth residential providers come down, whether they be churches or other private nonprofits. And there's always been an increasing concern over the lowered occupancy rates, which for them increases the per bed care. Has there been good communication by your department? Because this has been a change in the philosophy, and obviously in many cases it's certainly to the benefit of the young person. But what's happening to those providers? Are we losing needed capacity out there, and are they being kept apprised of what the department's role is?
Well, to answer the latter part first, as far as keeping them apprised, I think that they have been apprised for many years. I know, for example, when I was Director of Family and Youth Services, I went to most of their meetings in order to keep them apprised of the budget as well as the directions within the department. Also, since that I have been Deputy Commissioner as well as Commissioner, we have continued to do that, to have that process and open communication and not trying to do something to them as much as with them and where we're headed. It's very clear, you know, over the years that they have not been happy with the direction that we're trying to take. We have reduced the number of beds in residential care. We probably in the neighborhood of 65 to 80 beds we've reduced in the Anchorage Bowl area in the last 3 to 4 years. However, one caveat on that is that what we have done is regionalize a certain amount of those services. We have now have services, residential services, in Barrow, in Kotzebue, in Nome, in Bethel. We have them in all the communities, the big community in Southeast, Juneau, Sitka, in Ketchikan, as well as we have them in the interior. In Fairbanks, we have had beds over in Dot Lake. What has happened, though, in this year, which is unique, and you may be hearing something about it, if you remember last year, the Senate bill, was it 431 or 531? 431, yeah, 431 passed, which changed the mechanism by which we pay. We now have a grant system in which we went out to RFPs and we purchased a certain number of beds so that everybody would know up front how many beds we were going to pay for. And we pay up front for those beds, whether they're filled or not filled. And what we are attempting to do is ensure that we purchase the number of beds that we need. Well, we really don't have a problem with that at this point. Considering, as I mentioned, the number of beds that we've cut back over the last couple of years, we need all the beds that we're purchasing. But the system has been tough on Anchorage area services, because over the years, Anchorage had started gathered in all the services. And for example, ACS 2 years ago was getting 53% of the money out of residential care, Alaska Children's Services, right, in Anchorage. And now, in the new RFP for this last 6 months, they're getting a little more than 40%, and the rest of it is, you know, dispersed in the regional areas. So it has been difficult to them, and I wouldn't want to say it hasn't been. On the other hand, I think we have developed some services that we needed in regions that before were not only not served or very much underserved. And the rates of pay in those areas, that, remember, were very, very low. For example, in Bethel, we were paying like $70 a day, where at ACS, we were paying from $150 to $178. Well, it doesn't make a lot of sense when you think of the geographic differential. Well, now we're paying over $100 a day in Bethel, and we are able to demand a higher quality program here. And that was, there were other areas in rural Alaska which the same kind of thing had been going on. So there has been some equalization of rates and certainly a reduction of some of the beds in the south central area, and a dispersion of those beds to the regions.
Thank you.
Well,
go ahead then. Are you finished? Were you finished with your presentation?
Yes.
Well, before you get away. You had an interagency agreement that was consummated, I believe, September last year. Is that in progress? Is it working? How's it getting along? How's it going?
On interagency,
sex abuse protocol.
Yeah, sex abuse.
Well, I think it's working fairly well. In most of the areas, we are developing local protocols on the, you know, with using the protocol, the statewide protocol, as sort of the model for those local protocols. We have protocols in areas in Fairbanks and on the Kenai Peninsula and Wasilla Palmer. We have big geographic areas. We have it. I think in Anchorage, do we have a protocol? We do have a protocol in Anchorage, and I think that those protocols are working very well. We are continuing to try to train teams of individuals. There continues to be, of course, some difficulty in that. In the turnover, we train a team and, you know, three of the team members leave. A couple of years later, you have to start over again. The training on investigation continues to be a high expense item, but we are continuing to do that. I think that it is working better. I'm going to have Mike Price come up next. I think we need to let him talk a little bit about the child abuse neglect area, because I think it is one of the major areas that we're going to be looking at in the budget.
And we are faced with legislation concerning all the videotaping of testimony, et cetera. We passed that bill last year. Is that being used? What's the...
No, it did not pass last year. It's back up again. It's in the...
Oh, that's right.
Bill,
it gets moved. Yeah, over there.
But we do need it. There's no question we need it, particularly for very young children. It's a very difficult situation. I think with videotaping with young children, we'll be able to handle the prosecutions a lot easier.
On that subject, John, we're going to be taking up a bill, I think, to have hearsay testimony in grand juries. Do you have any opinion as to whether or not that's redundant of the videotape approach? I mean, it seems to me that if you did the videotape, you would allow the child to testify out of his or her own lips without the trauma, and that would obviate the need to go to the hearsay testimony. Is there a separate reason for doing both?
Perhaps I can help that. Manager and Senator Josephson, one of the other reasons might be times when a small child reported that the harm was occurring, say to a teacher or a friend, another friend's mother, and it's that hearsay also that sometimes needs to be admitted in the prosecution. The child's statement to a third party somewhere that something is happening to me at home, it's unpleasant. Other remarks they may have made before the investigation ever got started, before they would have been asked to be put on videotape. It can also include those other statements to third parties. And that might be what sometimes is allowed in as a hearsay of what the child says at some other point in time. I believe that's what the prosecution and Department of Law believes, that it would also be very useful for them.
You know, I'm confused. Wait a minute. In the statutes, look under 1214.047. 45. It's here.
The videotaping is?
Yeah.
There's some provision.
Upon application by the prosecuting attorney, the court shall permit the state to videotape the testimony of a child who is alleged victim of violation.
Then that must be the reason they're asking for hearsay. There may be some problem with that still being admitted as evidence because it's not, you're not appearing directly.
Maybe one of the problems is the trial judge shall preside at the videotaping session.
It might be.
But I would like you to look into this.
It may be deemed as a change to court rule, too, in a way.
Yes, it is deemed as a change of court rule.
Okay, speak English. What's a change of court rule? Here we go again. I did figure out ICFMR.
I'm sorry. I think there's a procedure when we change a court rule to have an extraordinary vote and an explicit reference that the legislation changes a court rule. And when we don't do that, either by one or the other, both, the issue is the validity of the statute because it impairs the court's control of its own procedures. That question might arise with that statute. I don't know, but that's a possibility.
If it arises with that statute, what's to keep it from arising with hearsay evidence?
Well, because there's a constitutional procedure for specifying that it's a court rule. I think it requires a 2/3 vote.
And the hearsay bill has that as a provision.
And that has a specific provision.
Yeah,
bill
this year, so.
Well, we passed a bunch of laws for them without 2/3 vote or something, if we're not.
Madam Chair, we've passed a lot under the court rule already, so.
But I hear what you're saying about how the prosecutor would like to do that, and I don't know how I'm going to resolve this conscientiously, have to choose, it seems to me, between the constitutional idea that we abhor hearsay testimony in criminal prosecutions against the desire we all have to protect children. And having gone to the video, supported the videotape idea, then to go to hearsay beyond that, I'm just wondering, you know, we're going to have to make that balanced judgment as to whether we're starting to impair the right of cross-examination of an accuser. And since we had the videotaping, that's why I asked what gain there is in asking for the hearsay.
Commissioner, if it's all right with you, and through the chair, Senator Joseph, I think that law will come in testifying those bills. There's a governor's bill which only asks for hearsay to be allowed at the grand jury level, not in the actual trial. There are other bills introduced, I believe, in the House, and in the Senate, that include hearsay at trial, and there may be significant differences in law should come in and testify. The other thing about the videotaped rule, to Madam Chair, is that the videotaped legislation that you passed talks about videotape after a case is actually a court case, and there is a presiding judge who could be in attendance and do this. In investigations, early investigations, the prosecutors want to sometimes be able to videotape some of the very first statements taken from that child witness, which are during investigative stage, maybe before there's even going to grand jury, before there's a presiding judge, because it is not yet a court case, it is an investigation. And there are sometimes videotapes made of the children playing in the rooms with the anatomically correct dolls to get their early statements. And it may be, I think law says, and I think they should speak for that, that that may be the other reason they need an extension of this hearsay testimony.
Thank you for your patience with my questions.
Fine. And we'll start with Mike Price, so you can talk about child abuse.
Good. And they are going to speak English, right?
Oh, yeah.
I remember that.
I was on it. I was a step game. I changed it. I mean, we're going to take a legal issue. I'm in my car.
Dan, would you run off?
Oh, yeah.
Get one of you to post them.
Maybe people do it.
You know, committee, I want to apologize. I think we were probably overzealous in thinking that we could have an overview from Hess in one afternoon. My idea was that we'd kind of touch on a little of this and they would know where we wanted to come back, if you remember. But we haven't even gotten through the commissioner, and I'm already wanting to come back, so...
We'll definitely be available if you want to do some more, because I do think it is a big department.
Oh, we need some more in-depth, and there, if you, as we said in the other committee, if you'll notice, there's a great deal of interest in it, and people who are on this committee are strictly here because we want to be, and are interested, so we have some questions that we want to know about.
Madam Chair, would you ask that question about... 3 months from now as to whether we still want to be here. I came in knowing something, and I know more.
Madam Vice Chairman, I wouldn't guarantee it next week. Correct.
Actually, I was planning to give you a brief overview today of our division, and my hopes were to be invited back to talk about our child abuse report to the governor. And then we have another report. This is the report that you already have. We shared it with you. And I hope to spend some time with you in discussing some detail. And we have another report that we are preparing for the governor regarding delinquency in Alaska, about the same size and same complexity.
Is there any chance that size and complexity could get into, and it may be that we have the time, but you know that, what is it now, kids, 114, 112? I don't know, I've lost it somewhere already. But it keeps looming out there. And yet we do want as much depth of understanding as possible. So give the overview as you wish, and yes, sir, you will be back 1 or 2 days.
Fine, thank you very much.
We'll work it out.
So what I'll do today is just give you an overview of our agency and how we function, its size, and the complexity of its services. And then my hopes are, like I say, to come back and discuss in much more detail on two big issues that each of you have raised here. The role of the division gets mandated, actually, to provide services directly or to arrange services to provide care for delinquent children, delinquent youth, and dependent adults. And the division is one of the larger divisions of state government. We have a total budget of about $55 million. We have almost 500 staff. It has very diverse and complex programs that range from pre-maternal care to care for the elderly. And in fact, in FY84, the division served some 16,000 clients, about 3%, almost 3.5% of the statewide population. Organizationally, we have really two branches to our organization. That's social services and youth services. I'd like to talk a little about social services first. And social services has approximately $11 million and has some 220 staff that provide those services. We're organized into five regional offices located in Fairbanks, in Anchorage, Ketchikan, Bethel, and Nome. And we have some 36 field offices that are located in those regions, in those five regions. Now, Youth Services has a total budget of some $13 million with some 248 employees. Some $9 million is spent annually for secure treatment facilities, treatment and detention facilities. Now, those facilities are located in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Nome, and Juneau, and they employ some 188 employees. And we will be discussing at a later date our plans for those facilities. We spend approximately $4 million in what we call probation services, and we have some 77 full-time staff that provide those services. And they're located in regional offices and in district offices. And we have some three regional offices for youth services located in Fairbanks and Anchorage and Juneau, and approximately 30 field offices. Our central office, and this is the whose role is to manage these two branches of our organization consists of some 36 staff members and represents about 7% of our total staff resources. And the role of our central office is to develop policy and procedure, to monitor programs, to prepare budgets and provide fiscal accountability, and staff development and training as well. The cost of our central office operation is approximately $1.7 million, and it represents about 3% of our annual operating budget. So no matter how you look at it, whether you look at it in context of staff resources or in total dollars, we have a very streamlined central office operation. I'd like to talk a little about the services we provide for social services under the social services branch. And last year, we had some 11,000 cases of children and adults that we served in FY84. And that's about 2% of the statewide population. The statutory mandate is for child protection is AS 4710 and AS 4717. Just to give you some idea of the growth and the demand for these services, between FY78 and 83, a six-year period, there was 122% growth in the number of children receiving protective services. And in fact, there was 173% growth in our total caseload. And this is a phenomenal growth when you think of it in annual terms. During that same six-year period, reports of neglect increased 219%, physical abuse reports increased 186%, and sexual abuse reports increased 270%. Now, to provide services for this client population, we do that directly through our social work staff, and we purchase care for clients also. Now, the kinds of direct services that we provide is assessment and referral, individual and family counseling, crisis intervention, investigation of reports of harm, and casework services. We also seek legal protection for both children and adults. Regarding purchase services, we purchase homemaker services, we purchase out-of-home care such as emergency shelter, foster care, and private residential care. This was a group that you had asked about earlier. We also provide daycare. Now, just to give you an idea of the cost of these services, for instance, we call Child Protective Daycare. We spent some $250,000 last year to service some 430 children who were victims of neglect, physical, or sexual abuse. For Child Protective Homemaker Services, we spent some $350,000 to provide protection for some 432 children. Regarding foster care, we spent some $5 million last year to provide care for what we call 614 FTEs. And let me explain what that means. It's what we call full cost equivalent. You know, children come in and out of foster care. And what we try and do is if a child stayed in care for an entire year, we'd be able to serve 614 children. That's an annual cost of approximately $8,000 a year per child. Now, we spend, for private institutional care, some $11 million to serve some 232 FTEs, an annual cost of $42,000 per year. That's very expensive, especially when you think that a social worker line MSW social worker in Anchorage is paid about $40,000 a year. Total benefits, I'm talking about retirement benefits and health benefits for that employee. So this is a very expensive form of care and why we are concerned about cost containment. On the other hand, we believe that even though we've reduced the number of total beds for private institutional care, we have sufficient resources for the group of children that need to be served by it. Other services that we provide are what we call preventative services. And one form of that is licensing independent care facilities. That would be, for instance, foster homes, daycare, private residential care. And as a matter rare fact, we license some 1,900 facilities in Alaska with a capacity of about 15,000. And this is accomplished with about 15 licensing orders. Another form of prevention is what we call the Preventative Youth Services Grants. And last year, we provided some 20 grants to 12 different Alaskan communities. And this is targeted services for child abuse and neglect, for delinquency prevention, and served approximately 12,000 children and adults.
Are those to private nonprofits, to communities, or what?
Private nonprofits and communities. We have another program called Work Incentive Program, WIN, that is an employment-related social service that provided services to approximately 1,000 families in 1984. Now, I'd like to talk a little about adult protective services. This is a voluntary service with the exception of the investigation of elder abuse as mandated in AS 47-2. And to give you an idea of the size of our caseload, in 1984 we served about 1,700 adults. Between 1978 and 1983, a six-year period, there was a 363% increase in the number of adults receiving services by our agency. Services for adults are provided directly by our social work staff and purchased from private providers. And the kinds of direct services we provide are assessment and referral, initiation of legal intervention when necessary, and case planning and case management. Purchase services are homemaker support, foster care, and private residential care. And to give you some idea of the cost of those services, last year, 84, the homemaker program cost our division approximately $1,900,000, and we served 957 clients. We also provided private residential care at a cost of almost $1 million for some 200 clients. We have a small program that is just beginning called Adult Foster Care. It's a few years old now. And we served some 79 clients last year at a cost of about $30,000. Now, what I'd like to do is shift next to youth services, and that's the other branch of our agency. And youth services is mandated under AS 4710, and it's to protect the public, and it's to prevent delinquency. Last year, 1984, there were approximately 5,300 arrests for delinquent acts in Alaska. And the kinds of services that we provide are first community-based services, and this is provided by our probation officers. And they do intervention, diversion, and probation. Last year, we did approximately 1,800 court intakes. There were some 1,700 youth who received probation services, of which 265 youth received informal probation. Now, regarding detention, which is another service we provide, this is a secure confinement following arrest and awaiting adjudication and disposition. We served 2,400 youth last year. And regarding institutional treatment, we treated some 125 youth in our facilities. Just in summary, I'd like to talk to you about some of the major issues and accomplishments of the division in FY84. In terms of management, we have decentralized management of our agency in two regions, and we expect enhanced management efficiency by doing so. We've developed we are in process of developing a new management information system, and it's our expectation that we can more efficiently use the resources we have and the new resources we hope we can receive this year. We are also coming out with an RFP to implement what we call a case management system, which allows us to better allocate the resources we have. There are some programmatic changes like I'd like to just mention briefly. This year, we are implementing HB 39, which is a pre-maternal services legislation, and we have just recently, we are coming out with grants for 12 communities at a cost of approximately $700,000 for this service. SB 431, which was designed to replace full cost of care for private residential care, for payment of private residential care, and that has been changed from full cost of care to a granting mechanism. And just recently, we allocated 26 grants for a total cost of about $5 million. And our commissioner has discussed with you the assumption of juvenile board intake December 3rd of this year. And prior to this time, about 60% of all intake was done by the court system, and the other 40% was done by our division. And from now on, we'll be doing 100% of all intake. And we expect to deal with between 5,000 and 6,000 youth this year.
Mm-hmm. Fine. Thank you very much, Mr. Price. Are there members that have questions at this time?
Just give an example of social abuse.
Social abuse.
I thought I heard you say social abuse, and I couldn't figure out what social abuse.
Oh, I'm sorry, I mean, physical abuse, sexual abuse.
Okay, I thought you said physical and social, and I thought it was social abuse. Okay.
That's when you're in the minority of the Senate. That's
Senator, can you see the bruises upon my body? are there other questions? Mr. Price, I appreciate the fact that you'll be coming back before us, but do you have any areas of difficulty of, say, coordination with other service deliverers? And I guess I'm looking at the Council on Domestic Violence. Is a problem there? Are you working well with that agency? Are there overlaps in any of the programs that you have?
Well, I don't perceive overlaps. I have been our department's representative on the council, and my perception is that we have different tasks and different responsibilities. There may be some disagreement about that, but I think that when you look at how the agencies operate and what their roles are, there's a clear distinction between our agencies.
Are the major problems you see for your division in actually serving the public? Can you identify those?
Well, yes.
You know, it's very nice to have a report, and it seems like things are fine, but I know there are always difficulties when you're dealing with the magnitude of the cases.
Actually, our report will be discussing some very severe problems that we have in serving children who are physically and sexually abused. And it has a great deal to do with the tremendous growth in reporting and a very limited growth in our resources to meet those needs. And so we have very, very high caseloads, and they very much impair our ability to serve children.
All right, so in other words, it's very important that we get you back to discuss those two reports.
I hope to.
Fine.
Back.
Thank you very much. Commissioner,
Mr. Price, you have. This is a question that is in kind of an inevitable one. Do you have a sense as to whether the growth in reporting is attributable to a growth in the incidents or a growth in the freedom from stigma to allow the reporting to come in or mandatory reporting to occur? I mean, have we always had the problem out there, but under the table, so to speak? Or are we seeing a change in society with greater permissiveness or for other reasons that is bringing about a change in mores?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer. My own personal belief is that the answer is both, that we're seeing a growth in reporting. I remember when I first started in social work right out of college in 1965, people barely talked about neglect, let alone about physical abuse, and now we're dealing with social abuse. And I think there is a recognition that there's an enormous problem there that needs to be dealt with. However, we've seen enormous social change in the last 20 years also, rise in divorce, the rise in population mobility, the breakdown of family life. And I think to see it as one single cause would not be a correct way to view it.
Well, do you identify a particular phenomena in Alaska different from the lower 48 that create these problems?
I'm not sure about that. I've been in Alaska since 1971, and I've worked all over the state for this agency. One thing that I do recognize is that we've had a huge increase in our population over that 12, 15-year period. And Alaska's a very different place than when I came here 13, 14 years ago.
Well, when I was thinking about coming to Alaska, I read an article in the New Yorker, Madam Chairman, that said that Alaska was a magnet for neurotics, so I came. I said, that's for me. Is it still a magnet for neurotics, do you think? Or?
I don't have a personal.
No, but it's an interesting. It's a question that's been raised a lot of times, and it sounds like there aren't statistics that tell us why we're where we are. But I certainly be of interest to see where we are.
Well, I can say this: is that Alaska does represent what's happening in the national trend. Although we like to think ourselves as quite unique, it appears that we have a lot of similarities with the lower 48.
And I hope not leading as we do in certain categories. Senator DeGreef?
Yes. Is it appropriate to ask me a budget question?
It's appropriate if...
Okay.
Certainly.
Okay. In the budget that you presented, that the governor has presented to us, is there capital outlay for another youth facility?
For two.
For two.
Right.
Okay. Where would those be?
Well, just this summer, the Department of Corrections transferred the Johnson Human Services Center here in Juneau to our agency. And presently it functions as a detention center, and we'd like to expand its treatment capacity, so it'll be both a detention and treatment facility for Southeast. Then we have a facility in Nome and a 9-bed facility, and we'd like to expand that another 9-10 beds to serve the Bush population. This is in response to severe overcrowding at both McLaughlin Youth Center in Anchorage and Fairbanks. And we would like to, instead of building onto those facilities, our plan is to decentralize those programs, provide those programs on a regional basis. And now, of course, we
go ahead, Bill.
Sure. There is currently an expansion going on in Fairbanks, and we have funds to build a new facility in Bethel. And the plans are by 1988 to have completed a regional system of facilities to relieve the overcrowding in both Fairbanks and Anchorage, and to provide a significantly better level of services to children and protection for the public.
Thank you very much, Commissioner.
One question, one thing I would like to comment to is that we are still looking at what we do in areas that we might call sub-regional areas. For example, the Kenai Peninsula. What do we do for detention on the Kenai Peninsula? What do we do for detention in the Amawasilla area where we have significant population centers? That's unresolved at this point. We've looked at the possibility of contracting with local communities as the adult, as public safety does, to do that kind of function and to develop good facilities that would certainly separate adults from children. We don't have an answer to that yet because the entire system's not in place, but we are looking at those sub-regional areas because there is a need for some detention beds in other areas.
Yeah, if I might add, is that our report to the governor will be giving an overview of the many complex problems that the system must deal with, and my hope that I can be invited back and discuss that report with you also.
I guarantee you will be. One comment I'd like to make, and maybe it's premature and maybe it's too late, but the figures that you've just given us on the services that we offer and the costs, and you look at those costs and they're staggering.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And then you look at the needs that are not being met. And the places where we're so far below where we should be. And that's frightening. And then you look at whether we are or not, and I'm inclined to believe we are, in a deficit position of over $300 million right now, much less what we're going to be the time we're looking at this budget. And man, these people are talking capital budgets. How are we going to hold our own? So it seems to me that it's time that we, you know, as we set our priorities, we also do some creative thinking on how we're going to increase the services and try to cut bed costs. You're the experts.
Sure. I had hoped to, as part of my second presentations, to talk about some of those issues that you had mentioned.
Please do.
Senator, I know that, you know, there's an absolute finite amount of need out there that we may have a responsibility to address, and I also know that our population is younger than many states. But I'd be interested to know how we compare with the other states in terms of the amount of effort we make per capita or as a proportion of the total budget. I'd like to know whether, you know, we're disproportionate or in the middle or modest in our effort. I think the public would like to know that too, because I feel sort of isolated, like I'm not sure whether we're doing more than most societies are doing or less or about the same.
There may be ways for us to find that information. I'll ask my staff to research and get a report back.
And along with that, I'd like to know, all those services that are not being met within the state, you know, what are the costs to the state for outside care, whether it's in specialized areas or what your suggestions are there. You know, that's a particular interest as we look at some of the services that are not being offered within the state and start considering those that it makes sense to offer and those that it makes no sense at all to offer because of the high technical skills and equipment and costs concerned with it. No problems at all this year, right? Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Is that door still locked?
No, I changed it.
Madam Chairman, do we have time for one more?
Yes, we do. And whomever's doing that, would they please at this time open the window? I think the closing of the door changes those. We're not getting through what... We're not getting through half of it, right?
Right.
Can we have a continuation, not this coming Thursday, but a week from Thursday, of what we're into now? And we'll try to, because I know there are going to be questions in other areas too, so I will try not to be so naive, but I had hoped just to skim the cream and move, but it's impossible.
Madam Chairman, I'm John Tabor, Director of the Division of Public Assistance, and in the very limited time available, I would like to just describe very quickly to the committee the seven programs that the Division administers, and take any questions that you may have. I'll make just some brief comments about our other priorities. The seven programs, the largest of the seven programs is the Aid to Families of Dependent Children program, the FDC. This program helps needy children who have low family income and resources and are deprived of one or both parents due to the absence, death, or disability of the other parent. Participation in this program makes the members of the household automatically eligible for Medicaid and for energy assistance. In Alaska, the typical household is a mother and two children. They receive $729 per month, or 79% of the federal poverty level in Alaska. $591.83 is the average payment that we expect to be making in 86, so a little bit less than what that typical household receives. There are 6,850 households that we expect to be serving each month in fiscal 86. Alaska operates a bare bones program under federal rules. We have just two optional components. Those are the pregnant woman and step-parent components, which account for less than 5% of our total expenditures, those options do. Alaska program participation rate at 3% of our state population is well below California. Hopefully in answer to your question, Senator Josephson, well below California, which is at 6.4%, Hawaii at 5.2%, and Washington State at 3.7%, but is slightly above Oregon, which has 2.7% of its population in its program, and Idaho with 1.8%. Alaska shares all of the program costs, except computer support, at a 50-50 share ratio with the federal government. Computer support is, thanks to recent certification by the federal government of our new computer system, paid 90%, reimbursed 90% by the federal government. The second program is old age assistance, age of the blind and age of the disabled, which are lumped together under the collective title of adult public assistance, or APA. These programs provide cash assistance to citizens who are over age 65, are blind, or are permanently disabled. The program supplements and is closely linked to the Federal Supplemental Security Income Program, which pays a maximum of $325 monthly this year. Participation in this program also makes the client automatically eligible for Medicaid, and to the extent that they are participants in the federal SSI program, they're also automatically eligible for energy assistance. Alaska also provides interim assistance in the amount of the state supplement only, that is, the supplement to the $325 to clients who are awaiting a determination of disability. So in that sense, we provide interim assistance. The average state payment in fiscal 86 will be $232.14, and this will guarantee, when added to other income and supplemental security income, an income of $595 per month, or 110% of the federal poverty level in Alaska of $7,140 a year.
Madam
a lot of statistics, bear with me.
But with respect to old age assistance, we had a speech on the floor of the Senate the other day by a colleague of ours who was expressing great skepticism about the implications of the longevity bonus program on, I think, some 800 senior citizens who receive old age assistance.
Yes.
The issue being whether an annuity program would knock out those folks and hurt them economically. At some point, when Senator Fahrenkamp can provide the time, I'd like to have your views of that so we can get the facts, because I think that's going to be critical to us as we plan that longevity bonus.
I'd be pleased to discuss that with you. The financial implications are important. The medical assistance implications are even more important under that program. And, of course, Rod Beatty, who directs the Division of Medical Assistance, would be able to speak to those issues for you. But we'd be happy to return and discuss that. We do expect to serve about 4,890 adult public assistant clients each month next year. The next program is the food stamp program. Administrative costs for food stamps are shared 50-50 with the federal government, but the benefits are paid 100% by the federal government. Approximately 25,000 people receive food stamps each month in Alaska, and that's about 5% of our population. Now, that sounds like a lot of people, but that's about one half of the national participation rate. Nationwide, approximately 10% of the population participates in food stamps. In Alaska, it's 5%. Rural clients get 30... Yes, Senator.
What are the eligibility requirements for food stamps now? Has there been any change recently? Or?
No, there's been no recent change in eligibility, and it's tied to the net family income after certain deductions for earned income disregards, and depending on the size of the family and so on. So it's kind of hard to give you a sliding scale there, but... basically, in order to qualify, a family of three would have to have an income of less than about $750. But again, their benefits are scaled to their actual income. So qualification might mean a $10 grant, not necessarily a full grant. Rural clients in Alaska do get 37.5% more coupons than urban clients due to the higher food costs in the bush. It doesn't obviously compensate for the highest food costs in the most high-priced areas, but it is an average that is permitted by the federal government. Benefits vary greatly with household size and income, but the average allotment in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, that is in the urban areas, is about $200 per month. Large households and low incomes in rural areas drive monthly benefits as high as about $743. I took as an example of a six-person zero-income household. The state is pushing federal legislation that would ease administrative requirements in rural areas and make the program more accessible in those areas. The next program is General Relief Assistance, our GRA program. It provides payment for emergency needs. It's used primarily to pay rent and indigent burials. In order to qualify for the program, you must be truly indigent, earning less than about $300 per month, and have less than $500 in any sort of cash or liquid resources. The limitation is $80 per month per person in terms of cash assistance, which is provided as a vendor payment to a provider of services. And burial assistance is now set at about $1,000. That's $750 for the basic services and then additional for transportation and so on. We expect to serve about 4,500 Alaskans in 1986 in this program. Energy assistance.
Burial assistance?
I'm sorry?
Total.
Senator?
How many will you be serving in burial assistance?
Not 40.
Burials is about 25 per month. So whatever that works out to, 280, 275, something in that neighborhood. Energy assistance is our next program. The costs of administration and benefits are both 100% federal. We serve about 16,000 households in 1986. Most households that earned less than 150% of the federal poverty level in Alaska are eligible to participate in this program. We adjust benefits locally based on the fuel costs in different regions of the state. And although federal rules permit direct cash payments to households, we choose to distribute most benefits as payments to energy vendors. In other words, we've avoided putting cash directly in the hands of clients in most cases. Our division shares the administration of the Energy Assistance Program with a number of Native organizations who receive their funding directly from the federal government. And we work closely with those groups to assure similarity of benefits and services. Medicaid and general relief medical assistance, finally, are administered by